I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Ukraine crisis. An offensive in winter. That's right. It is winter in Ukraine, and both sides are evidencing renewed fighting using large artillery weapons, Grad rockets fired at each other or at civilians. There are puzzles here as to who's doing the firing. Both sides, the rebel forces associated with Moscow and the National Guard associated with Kiev, are blaming the other side when there are civilian casualties. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian history, joins, and we have a deal to cover, so I'll give the points of the fighting, and then we'll get into what's going on in Russia as this unfolds. Beginning a week ago, there were reports of at Donetsk Airport, the rebels had closed on a Kiev force and either captured it or driven it out of Donetsk Airport. Fighting had been going on there heavily for many months. This under the rubric of a ceasefire, which is now a canard. Since then, there has been additional fighting at Mariupol. This is the port city that is the bridge from eastern Ukraine, Donbass, to Crimea. In other words, it would be a land bridge from Russia to Crimea, which is held by the Russian military at this point. Mariupol is also a place where many people have fled to get out of the fighting or to take refuge in a place that's supposedly defended by the Kiev forces. The Grad rockets landing in Mariupol have been evidenced on the video, YouTube, everywhere. You can see the rockets landing in civilian areas. Also, you can see that Mariupol is a very poor-looking place with Soviet architecture in the high-rises, people running about, Grad rockets landing in the middle of traffic, blowing up trucks, genuine panic. You feel it from the dash cams at Mariupol. Many condemned the Russians for those Grad rockets, including Petro Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine. I note that the prime minister of Ukraine also called for a meeting of the United Nations Security Council over the shelling. That was reported within these last days. Since then, there's been renewed fighting at Luhansk. This is in the north, Luhansk Airport, with the Luhansk Railroad Station. Within these last hours, you again can go to YouTube and see Grad rockets firing in the distance. It's very eerie. It's a red glow on a dark sky in a Ukraine winter battlefield. Now, the other thing that's important here that Professor Cohen will discuss tonight is how Russia is bearing up under the sanctions, because leaders of the EU, 28 members, right now are warning that they'll impose additional sanctions on the basis of the renewed fighting in Luhansk, in Donetsk, and Mariupol. I also mentioned that Moscow has now approved an anti-crisis plan. This is on the 27th, within these last hours. This, according to Russian Finance Minister Anton Silyanov. This is a one-year plan. It does not involve budget spending growth at all. In fact, we're in a major recession in Russia. Also, the warning here, a fifth of Russian banks are in danger of collapsing in 2015 because of the price of oil, because of the ruble, and because of the sanctions. Professor Cohen, a very good evening to you. I've given you a quick battlefield report. The fog of war descends on Mariupol and Donetsk and Luhansk, and also some evidence that Russia is sagging under the sanctions and under the collapse of the price of oil. A very good evening to you. What do we make right now of the fighting at Mariupol? This looks to favor the rebels if they capture the city. It also looks to favor Kiev if it can be demonstrated that the rebels are firing or the Russians are firing Grad rockets into civilian areas. Good evening, Steve.
John, I don't know if I've ever said this to you before, but every time you say, by way of greeting, a very good evening to you, I keep hoping one day there will be a very good evening in this Ukrainian crisis, because this evening the news is all terrible. More people are dying for reasons we may talk about later. I think we, the United States and NATO, may be edging toward actual war with Russia. What's going on with the fighting in eastern Ukraine is clear only if we put it, and partially clear, if we go back to the context we discussed last week. There was a proposal that if the ceasefire agreed upon back in September, and never really honored completely, but if it showed signs of becoming an expansive ceasefire, that Europe might end its sanctions on Russia very soon. And the opposite happened. Fighting intensified. And now I think it's fair to say that all-out war has broken out again in eastern Ukraine between the rebel armies backed by Russia and the Kiev armies backed by the United States. That's what's going on, and to a certain extent, Europe. So the question politically becomes, who started the new fighting? And we're in a fog of war. We're getting misinformation from everywhere, from Washington, from Kiev, from Moscow, from Europe. So we do our best not to make a mistake. All I can say is, based on what I've been able to study and have confirmed, that Ukrainian artillery, which was supposed to be withdrawn from a 30-mile kilometer, a buffer zone between the rest of Ukraine and East Ukraine, was not only not withdrawn, but resumed its attack on the cities at that very moment when an end to sanctions and maintaining the ceasefire was being discussed. And the rebels have said that they began fighting to defend their cities against the artillery, and that the main purpose of their fighting now is to drive Ukrainian artillery beyond the reach of their cities, which, I got to repeat, is where they live. These cities are their homes, where their families are. I think on balance, though each side is holding back some of the truth, I think on balance that the rebel story is more or less correct, and that therefore the Russian charge that Kiev continues to provoke the fighting by mobilizing artillery and troops against these cities is the triggering device. That said, and this takes us to Mariupol, once the rebel army, which has been supplied and trained now into a first-rate fighting force by Russia, though I don't think there are many Russians traveling with it, I don't know, but it's been resupplied. Once that rebel army took the Donetsk airport, once it began to push the artillery back as far as it could from Donetsk City, the biggest city in Donbass, it began to move again toward Mariupol and engaged in fire either in the direction of that city or in response to Ukrainian artillery. We don't know. But Mariupol is an enormous temptation for Russia and the rebel army. At the moment, the rebels control Luhansk and Donetsk, those two big cities. But Mariupol, which is a portside city, a seaport, and a potential land road to Crimea, now part of Russia, remains under the administrative control of Kiev. If it were to fall, let us say, to the rebels, militarily, politically, Kiev would no longer have any bargaining point with the East. The rebels would control the entire eastern part of Ukraine. And that would be to control really a lot. I mean, in terms of resources, I think the numbers are the province of Donbass produces 20% of the country's GDP and 25% of its exports. And that comes at a time when Ukraine, Kiev, is in economic collapse. Plus the symbolism of a rebel political leadership saying, we control the entirety of Donbass, of eastern Ukraine, plus the logistical possibility of going on to Crimea, ending Russia's problems with supplying that province. So the stakes are enormous. There is still a fog of war, and we can't be sure who's responsible or even who's winning. But I think what I've just said is very close to the truth, and it has now enormous political consequences.
Let's turn to those.
Washington is going to act on what it assumes to be true.
Let's turn to those consequences, because NATO's getting involved. We know that there are voices in the United States and in European media calling for the U.S. and for NATO to get directly involved in the fighting by arming Kiev. And when we come back, those voices and the call for arming Kiev, that is an arms race in Ukraine. And what does that mean for NATO's obligations up against the Russian Federation? Steve Cohen, Professor Steve Cohen, Russian History at Princeton University and NYU. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen is here, and we're looking at the fighting in eastern Ukraine, the renewed and extremely upsetting, if you see it on YouTube, fighting of Grad rockets landing in civilian areas. Luhansk, the Donetsk airport was flattened. We know that there were long-range Grodz flying into Donetsk before that. The long-range Grodz now cannot reach Donetsk, if I understand the map correctly. But Mariupol is now coming under Grodz fire and noticeably landing in civilian apartment buildings in these last days. Now we have a report of a U.S. delegation, U.S. and European delegation, touring Kiev recently, Steve, and a report coming out from distinguished members of the diplomatic community on the American side and the European side of the Atlantic. This is the NATO group recommending arming Kiev. Steve, what's the difference between arming Kiev and making Ukraine part of NATO?
That's a good question. If NATO, well, look, I mean, when I say fog of war, neither Washington nor Moscow tells us everything we need to know. Russia doesn't tell us the extent to which it has armed and trained the rebels. Washington doesn't tell us the extent to which it is funding and arming and training the Ukrainian army. Substantially, we know that. So NATO and the United States, but particularly the United States, is already running a proxy army in Ukraine against the rebel army. If this goes farther now, if there is a decision made in the United States, open decision, and acted on to give, quote, lethal, I've never known the difference between defensive and offensive weapons, but to give all manner of weapons and training to use those weapons to Kiev, in effect, America will be at war with Russia. It'll be a proxy war for a while, but I've always thought if could become a Cuban Missile Crisis. It could be real war, actual war. This report you refer to, it appeared in the Financial Times. At least that's where I saw it. Now, the Financial Times is an excellent newspaper, but also a conduit for very important reports. It was taken to the Financial Times because it is a newspaper that serves both Washington and NATO. And the report is that a bunch of really big guys in this country, former officials, both White House, State Department, and NATO officials, made, quote, and this is astonishing, it literally used this language, a fact-finding mission to Kiev and to NATO. Well, we know what facts they found there. Arm us and let's fight. They didn't make a fact-finding trip to Moscow or to Donbass or to anywhere else. They went with a purpose, they got the facts they needed, and in a couple days, I understand, in Chicago, at some big event, they're going to release this report which recommends that United States and NATO arm Ukraine to the limit.
Right.
And there is no discernible limit.
That means field-grade rockets to destroy Russian armor. That's what they're looking at. They're looking to neutralize what they see on the battlefield as the rebels' advantage. They have really good Russian equipment.
So, yeah, and so for those of us not privy to these maneuverings behind closed doors, what it would mean if adopted, this proposal, that we will, in effect, be at war with Russia.
Right.
Now, this is happening without any discussion in the United States. We're not being informed. We're not giving the chance to debate why we would want to do that, how it might turn out, whether it might go nuclear. Now, getting this story is hard. There's a young man, an excellent writer, lives in Washington, named James Carden. And he's all over this story. I think he's going to Chicago. And he's going to file a report on it, I think, in the Nation magazine very soon, next week. But so far as I know, he's the only he's not exactly a reporter. He's a writer with an instinct for news. We'll see what he turns up. But this we could be at a terrible turning
look
point.
Look at the quote from the president on Sunday, this following the Mariupol reporting.
Yeah.
The president concluded during his embassy to India that the fighting in Ukraine has, quote, Russian backing, Russian equipment, Russian financing, Russian training, and Russian troops. All right, that's the quote from the president. Now,
yep.
not too surprising there. We're no breakthrough. But in several months' time, Steve, we could see President Putin in Moscow saying that the fighting in Ukraine has American backing, American equipment, American financing, American training, and American troops. Why not? They would play tit for tat.
This is why you call me every now and then. Because I follow daily what's going on in Moscow. Putin said that 2 days ago. He said that this fighting force for Kiev in Donbass is an American NATO foreign legion, and that its motives there are not to do good things for the Ukrainian people, but to contain and weaken Russia. This was in a national television broadcast 2 days ago. He called it a foreign legion run by NATO and the United States. Well, I would because there's so many foreign fighters there, a few Americans have turned up too. But his point is that this military force exercised by Kiev now is essentially an American NATO force. Does he exaggerate? Yes. Does Obama exaggerate? Yes. But those are the kinds of exaggerations that lead to war. And there's one other thing that's bothered me, and I don't think I've mentioned it. It's clear from some of the things that President Obama says about Putin that this has become personal for him. His personal resentment toward Putin comes out in almost every statement he makes. For example, a few days ago he said, well, everybody said a few weeks ago Putin was such a great leader and I was indecisive. But I guess he doesn't look like such a great leader now. For the American president, a sitting American president, to say that suggests that he may have lost any objectivity about the policies that he's following.
My concern also, Steve, is NATO here, because NATO has nuclear weapons and Russia has nuclear weapons. And the frontier is not Ukraine. The frontier is Poland and the Baltic states. There's no reason to believe that this combat, okay, we can call it surrogate war, would be contained within Donbass. There's no reason to assume that.
The Washington and NATO have claimed that Putin has designs on the Baltic states.
Right.
That used to be part of Russia.
Right.
There is absolutely no evidence that that was or is the case. However, as you say, there's a rippling effect. There are ramifications. There's ricochets. And that an intensified war in eastern Ukraine will spill over elsewhere. And by the way, Moscow believes, and they say this repeatedly, and Kiev echoes it, reinforcing that belief, that if Kiev can take or defeat the Donetsk, defeat the rebel armies, Kiev will immediately march on Crimea. Now, please understand, whether we accept Crimea as a part of Russia or not, it will in effect be, if that were to happen, a war against Russia inside Russia.
That would be a catastrophe. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, we're going to turn to Russia next because they're suffering there and it's going to get worse. And what does that mean for the whole strategy of resolving Ukraine crisis? I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen is here, and we're discussing Ukraine crisis. The war fighting is very difficult to see. It's necessarily the fog of war. We know there's suffering, and we know there's threat from both sides. An arms race. Major arms flowing into Ukraine. These are big weapons, and attached to those weapons are systems that can get larger, including air and sea. But right now, we turn to the other weapon, the sanctions weapon. Steve, I note that Max Boot of the Council on Foreign Relations has a column recently. He's calling for arming the Kiev forces to match the Russian arms. But he also says he identifies a man by the name of Andrei Kostin. He's at Davos, who's said to be the CEO of Russia's second largest bank, the VTB. He says that Mr. Kostin identified what sanction would work on Russia, which is to cut Russia off from the SWIFT system. The quote here is from Mr. Kostin, the banker. If there is no SWIFT, there is no banking relationship. It means that the countries are on the verge of war, or they are definitely in a cold war. This is what Kostin says. Mr. Boot allows that it might be a hyperbole, but in any event, Boot calls for the U.S. kicking Russia out of the SWIFT system. In other words, cutting it off from its ability to do banking overseas. This tells me that Russia has to face the fact that it is in a financial war and it's losing. If I understand that budget that they've just issued in Moscow, they're preparing to dig in. You've told me over all many years, Steve, that the Russian people have a sense of suffering that we do not have in the United States. Can they take being cut off from the Western banking system?
The Russian people also have a perception of the world that we do not have. They generally, and the polls tell us, about 85%. That's pretty general. You can't get 85% even for Mother's Day in this country. 85% of the Russians today regard what's going on in Ukraine as an American Western war on Russia, period. And therefore, 85% in every poll, and these are not cooked polls, support Putin. Now, this banker, I saw that remark at Davos. Couple things to remember here. These young guys who go to Davos represent, and I want to get this right, they are Western-type people. For 20 years, they've made careers in representing Russian financial interests in the West and vice versa. They're all alternative bankers in waiting in Russia. So what they are doing is speaking to Russia as well. They're warning Putin, oh my God, don't get cut off for Davos. What he didn't say was, though, is that Russia has $400 billion of foreign currency reserves. The total debt in Russia at the moment, all those banks he mentioned, plus the state debt, is about $150 million a year for the next 2 years. So Russia, if it has to, the state can cover those debts. It may let banks go under, banks that shouldn't be there anyway. There are too many fragile banks in Russia. But generally speaking, for a while, Russia has the financial resources. Let me put this another way. Russia's debt ratio to GDP is 10%. What is the United States debt ratio to GDP? 100%. We print money to pay our debt. So on paper, Russia isn't quite as vulnerable. But there's something else. Russia has not played its cards, and this is openly discussed in Russia. If it is all-out financial war, including the SWIFT system, Russia can expropriate all the Western assets in Russia, all of them. Now, how many billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of corporate dollars? And that includes, by the way, oil drilling equipment in the Arctic. It could simply expropriate them on the grounds that we are at war. That's what governments do during war. They expropriate the enemy's possessions. Now, that is the last thing that Putin would want to do or do. But it is doable. And by the way, the Russian people would regard it in a most enthusiastic way. There's one other thing. I don't know enough about it to say if it's feasible, but Russia and China and the BRICS nations have been moving toward an alternative to the SWIFT system. The SWIFT system means that the dollar is the basic denomination for international transactions. Lots of countries have resented this. Why should the dollar, which is propped up by America's debt and printing paper, be the denominating currency? Let's do a mix of currencies and create an alternative system. If Russia were to be kicked out of the SWIFT system, and bearing in mind Russia's financial relations with China and the BRICS nations, which is in the trillions of dollars, it would abet the development of an alternative to the SWIFT system. And what would that do to the American economy and the American dollar?
These are questions,
but the answers are out there.
Within these last hours, Victoria Nuland of the State Department, who is a prominent voice in the Ukraine crisis since last winter, Assistant Secretary for European Affairs Victoria Nuland, speaking at the Brookings Institution, referred to sanctions. The quotes are, I will just give a few of them. Just a few weeks ago, said Ms. Nuland, around tables in Europe and in Washington, we were talking about how sanctions could be rolled back if and when the Minsk agreements are fully implemented. This is referring to a September ceasefire. She added, now after the past week of flagrant violations of Minsk on both sides of the Atlantic, we are forced to talk about the need to increase costs on Russia. She pointed to the fact that the EU leaders met within these last hours in Tuesday to talk about tasking their foreign ministers to toughen new measures on Russia for sanctions. I also mentioned, Steve, that Victoria Nuland referred to the war fighting by saying, NATO is a defensive alliance. Our goal is a deterrence of aggression. But if that fails, we have to be ready. They're not just talking about sanctions anymore, Steve. They're talking about sanctions with war fighting.
Well, it's kind of hard to think of NATO as solely a defensive organization after the war on Serbia in 1999, the war on Iraq, and the ongoing war in Afghanistan. There were no forces in those countries threatening to march beyond those countries' borders toward us. So I think, you know, that's boilerplate. Nobody takes it seriously. But what you've just described, John, takes us back to where we began. That narrative that Russia violated and the rebels violated the ceasefire last week, at the very moment when Hollande and other Europeans, President of France, were urging an end to sanctions, on Russia, correct? We were discussing that. And suddenly the ceasefire is not only violated, it collapses in the fury of a new war, which is underway as we talk, leads to exactly what Nuland said. And therefore, since Russia and the rebels are guilty, we have to go to war against Russia. Financial, military, and the rest. It's all in the narrative, John.
Listen to the rhetoric, Steve. It's surprising at Brookings. Brookings Institution is associated with being against the war in Iraq, against the war in Afghanistan, against American aggression. The quote from Victoria Nuland, this is stunning to me. She says, Ukraine's front line for freedom is ours as well. Did you know that, Steve? Has the Obama administration made the case to the American people that that's America in Kiev?
Well, that's what the president of Ukraine, Poroshenko, told Congress when he came here a few months ago. And for our war party, and for the war party in Europe, that has become the talking point.
And that's what
that Western freedom is now at stake on the barricade in Ukraine.
And to turn it upside down, that's what Mr. Putin's saying. He's saying this is an attack on us. That's America out there attacking us. And Ms. Nuland, in her fashion, is saying that's America defending Ukraine. They're both agreeing that it's America in the war.
I assume that your listeners understand where this can lead. We don't have to tell them again.
Well, let me remind, because I've done the reporting on this, but not everybody hears all the reporting from Joe Papalardo, who flew with a NATO AWACS out of Norway over Poland routinely, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The AWACS are maintaining total alert over the Polish frontier. They're training F-16s for rapid response for a Russian attack. They're also watching Russia on their side of the border with the same equipment, preparing their fighters for receiving NATO attack. Those are Cold War tactics. The surprise for my report, Steve, is that these men who are flying the AWACS out of Norway, they much prefer this duty to what they were doing in Afghanistan, which was highly dangerous to them. And they were flying over Taliban, who had ground-to-air missiles. They were always worried about their security. At least in Poland, they're well back from the Russian frontier, and they don't think they're going to be picked off from ground fighting. However, though they like it, they admit it is the Cold War, Steve. They've gone back 30 years.
And add to this or that what's going on the Western frontier in the air. Growing reports, not only out of Russia, that American and NATO ships are building up in the Black Sea with a potential capability of attacking Crimea.
Which is what you said, yes.
So when you look at these two pictures, East and West, both sides reacting to the other, you can see that the slippery slope toward war, there seems to be nothing to stop it at the moment. No political leadership, no intervening event. It's a terrible situation, John, and alas, it's played out almost inexorably, it seems, over the last 10 or 12 months.
Victoria Nuland, I mentioned, I came in on this because Steve understands the shorthand version. Victoria Nuland was a principal in the vulgar phone call that was intercepted by intelligence services. We can believe it was the Russians, and revealed last February during the crisis in Kiev when the government, Yevtushenko's government, failed and he fled. That was the moment when it became clear that the U.S. State Department was very much in charge of the transformation of Ukraine from a troubled and corrupt land into what looked to be a NATO and EU land. That was Victoria Nuland. The fact that she's speaking today, coterminous with these events in Mariupol, I don't know what it means, Steve, but I can presume that Moscow is going to have what you'd have to say is a harsh interpretation of these statements.
But we have to understand that Victoria Nuland, a high-level State Department official who served the government since the Clinton administration and served Cheney and Bush and continues under Obama, is not a free agent. She represents much larger forces in Washington. The view that since the Soviet Union ended nearly 25 years ago in 1991, Ukraine has been the great prize, the brass ring, has been written by every neocon geopolitical strategist, as they call themselves, who comments on Russian-American relations. The expansion of NATO to the Baltics was great. The attempt to bring in Georgia failed, but Georgia's little. But Ukraine is the prize. And it goes back to this theory, geopolitical theory, that Brzezinski once, Zbigniew Brzezinski once formulated, that with Ukraine, Russia's great power. Without Ukraine, Russia's not much of anything. I don't think that's exactly right, but that is the premise on which the new Cold Warriors, since the end of the Soviet Union, have acted. We are headed eventually, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, toward Ukraine. Now we're there. And Nuland represents this, you know, she's a neocon. She says she is. She's married to the leading neocon philosopher. But behind her stand forces, and the best we can tell, is Obama has farmed this policy out to Vice President Biden, who operates with Kerry, to whom, Kerry, Nuland is answerable. So there is a vertical, as Russians say here, that leads right into the White House, right into the Oval Office. The mystery of where Obama stands on this is only whether he's behind it or he doesn't understand it.
Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian history. When we come back, the 70 years since Auschwitz-Birkenau were freed, liberated by the Soviet Army, celebrated, remembered, noted in Moscow today by Vladimir Putin, who was not invited to Poland. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. 70 years since the liberation, the freeing, the discovery of the horror of Auschwitz-Birkenau in Poland. It was run over by the Soviet Red Army on its way to conquering the Nazi army and driving all the way to Berlin. To read, the Soviet soldiers who arrived didn't know what they were seeing, didn't understand it at first. You can see the pictures today of the Soviet officers and enlisted men interacting with what remains of the inmates. Many had been evacuated. Others had been murdered on a march. This is wintertime to the west to cover up the Auschwitz-Birkenau mass murder. But Vladimir Putin was in Moscow today to remember who freed the prisoners that remained. He said at a ceremony at the Jewish Holocaust Museum in Moscow, "We bow our heads before the feet of the soldiers and officers of the Red Army who defeated Nazism and stopped the horrific machine of extermination." He went on to say, "A great liberating mission has become a matter of honor for our entire people." Steve, that's a setup for the commemoration of the Great Patriotic War that's coming in May. Everybody in Russia knows that's what he's pointing to, correct?
Yeah, and I think the older generation of Americans, my generation, know that what's happened in the last two or three weeks in Kiev, an attempt to rewrite the history of World War II, and particularly the liberation of Eastern Europe, and especially the liberation of Auschwitz and other death camps, to delete the role of the Red Army and write in instead not only the United States and the UK, but even Ukraine into this liberation process is an obscenity. The Prime Minister of Ukraine said, first of all, it wasn't Russia that liberated Auschwitz. It was soldiers from Ukraine, but they were in the Soviet Army. This is untrue. They were probably Ukrainians in those Soviet Red Armies moving toward Poland and toward Auschwitz, but it was primarily a Russian army led by Russians, and it was undoubtedly a Soviet, not a Ukrainian, liberation. The other way they've gone about rewriting this war is to introduce the notion that the Soviet Union in World War II occupied Germany and Ukraine. Now, we had thought that Germany occupied the Soviet Union, including the Ukraine. But now it's turned out that the Soviet Union occupied Ukraine and Germany. When this was announced, there was an uproar in Germany and an uproar in the United in Europe about how could anybody say such a thing. And silence in the United States, except our president, about a week ago, published an article co-written with the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, David Cameron, which stated above their names, we, the United States and the United Kingdom, defeated Nazi Germany. Leave aside the French freedom fighters, they never mentioned the Soviet Union, which statistically and in terms of years, any military historian will tell you this, on the so-called Eastern Front, following the German occupation of the Soviet Union invasion on June 22, 1941, the Red Army drove the German war machine out of the Soviet Union, out of Poland, and all the way back to Berlin. The Americans landed in Europe on Normandy in June 1941 and then marched on to Berlin to hook up with the Red Army. This is an obscenity to say these things. And what I don't understand, and maybe you do, John, is saying such things by the government officials at the highest level, including the President of the United States, a function of the fog of war that we're now headed toward? Or is it a justification of a war against Russia by saying, well, the Russians never really did anything to defeat Nazi Germany. And yeah, there might be a few fascists running around the Ukrainian government today in Kiev, but Russia is the enemy and always has been. I don't understand how people can say such things, and still more, it can go uncommented on in the American media. One other point. Today or yesterday, the most liberal anti-Putin radio stations called Echo Moscow did a poll of its listeners, polled 37,000 people. Now remember that the listeners of this newspaper are not well disposed toward Putin. They're pro-Western. And they asked if these statements that I've just quoted suggest that America and the West are trying to rewrite the history of World War II. And the person who conducted the poll said that in the first time in our history of polling Russians, our listeners, about anything, we got an 85% response. And the answer is yes. So even the most liberal audience in Russia is outraged by these statements about World War II. And why they're being made, I understand why the Ukrainian government is making them. But why Obama would echo them and why they would go unremarked upon in American newspapers, I cannot explain.
Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus, Ukraine Crisis continues another day. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show.